Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, COVID in the courts, or maybe not, as the case may be. So, Richard, big debate happening on Capitol Hill right now with Republicans and President Trump on one side, congressional Democrats on the other. And the GOP's argument here is that as a condition of any further spending meant to mitigate the fallout from COVID-19, they want liability protections erected for businesses and institutions that could be facing lawsuits from customers or employees who say that they caught the disease at their facility, and thus the company should be liable. So I want to start kind of with the basics here. The communication of infectious diseases and the prospect of that happening in some commercial setting is not new. So, Richard, it would seem like we'd already have relevant legal standards in place here. Is that not the case?
The answer is it is and it isn't. In terms of the kinds of standards that are going to happen, there are all sorts of standards that talk about the obligations of proprietors to their customers or employers to their employees, either under the tort law or more commonly under the workman's compensation law. There are also lots of rules dealing with the liability of cruise ship owners with respect to their customers and so forth. And generally, the way in which the standard has played out in the abstract, and I stress that phrase, is you have to have fairly strong knowledge of a particular kind of danger that you're in a particularly effective position in order to protect. Mere foreseeability, as it is often pointed, is not going to be sufficient to create that liability. It's sort of a heightened awareness of what is going to happen. And the explanation for that basic standard in most of these cases is these kinds of injuries are so pervasive and so difficult that if you have the lowest standard, every single institution is going to turn out to be bankrupt. This has certainly been the case with respect the people who are worried about, for example, liability of condominium boards and overseers to churches and hospitals, most of whom serve without pay, most of whom essentially have other kinds of occupations. The thought that you can reach these particular people under a very lax standard is thought to be sufficiently dangerous that it will drive everybody away from doing the kind of work that has to be done. That's the first side of it. The second side of it is you don't look at this as a system of negligent oversight. What you do is you look at this as a system of disease. And the key issue that one starts to worry about is causation. One of the things that we know about diseases is that they spread in very strange ways. And it's extremely difficult to pin down, except under rare circumstances, who is responsible for what. So it turns out that you go into a hospital and there are other patients sitting in the waiting room. There was a cab driver who took you there. There's some various people who are going to treat you, some of whom from the hospital, some not. It turned out that you'd also been with relatives before this happened, and you emerged with some form of COVID-19. There are no tracks which tell you which of the 20-odd people that you've been in contact with for the previous hours is the one who gave it to you. Indeed, this disease is sufficiently complicated that my guess is if you had divine inspirations as to the movement of every molecule of the coronavirus, you would discover that most people who get this will get it from multiple people. That's certainly the situation with respect to people who, for example, were in the subway. So you take the following hypothetical. Anybody who's been on the subway since, say, March 1st now wants to sue the New York Transportation Authority on the ground that it has sufficient warning to allow them to basically thin out the crowds and so as to prevent the spread of the virus through mass transit. As a generic matter, I think there's no doubt whatsoever that the train and the subway system with all of those conditions was one of the major reasons why New York City has been harder hit than anywhere else. Nobody else has mass transit like this. You go into Chicago in terms of the packing, it's a joke in terms of the density. You go to Washington, D.C. or to Boston, it's the same thing. Do we really want to have the entire New York system subject to some kind of tort law? Do we want this to be litigated on the question of whether or not there's some sort of a municipal immunity which we're not going to give to private operators of some sort or another. I think what has always been the case and the great stumbling block with respect to these disease kind of cases is that the transmission and the causation that starts to take place is so particularly complicated that since you don't know where the virus is going to come from, you're not going to be sure which of the multiple agencies that you have should be in a position to deal with the issue. Then the other problem is going forward. We have a huge problem now in getting people, even if you lift the ban, to undertake certain activities. The medical evidence on this is tolerably clear. I use the word with caution, in which it turns out that in places like New York City, the death rate amongst people who are exposed to COVID who do not have any comorbidities, they don't have diabetes, they don't have cancer, they don't have asthma or whatever it is about basically less than 1% of the total number of deaths. Virtually everybody else in there has been either older or with a comorbidity or typically both. So now what you're going to do is you're going to open these places up, and people are going to come in. The merchants will not open themselves up if they think they're going to be held liable to customers who come into their places to eat or to buy something. And, of course, any customer that goes into one place is probably likely to go into 5 or 10, and then you have the question of how do you pin the liability. So the view with respect to diseases is very much different from the view with respect to traditional kinds of torts. The answer is you just grin and bear it. There are first-party healthcare systems to try to take care of the medical stuff, and you don't give death benefits, you don't give pain and suffering, you don't give lost income. And I think that's probably the right result. So if I were a Republican, I would say, look, we have not denied healthcare to anybody who's come into the system based upon the want of an ability to pay. We're going to keep that particular system in place. But if you're going to try and get individual causation, you will so overwhelm the system that we will not be able to spend really necessary resources on minimizing these futures. So I am strongly opposed to trying to create these situations. There are odd cases like, you know, everybody's caught on the same boat at one time where you know what the cause is. But I think even when you try to work with those kinds of cases, it's going to be awfully complicated. So I wrote about this a long time ago when this thing first started. And in general, I don't think the workman's compensation system, I don't think the tort system is in a peculiar way to do this. I think we carve the current set of benefits that we do provide. It's imperfect. It's somewhat erratic. But I have no doubt that we're much better trying to defend people who are vulnerable from being exposed rather than trying to find ways to hold people liable for the infinitely variety type situations that are going to emerge. The moment you put this thing into liability and you ask people to take depositions and so forth, every individual case, every class action will be a litigation and administrative nightmare.
Walk us through the federalism aspect of this, Richard, because a lot of this liability law is determined and acted upon at the state level. So how good of a rationale is there for having the federal government sweep in here to start setting the standards?
Well, I mean, this has been a chronic interest. It goes under the nature of preemption. And the question has long been raised, if the federal government has decided that it wishes to insulate certain kinds of activities from various forms of liability, can it do it with respect to the states? And the answer to that question is actually unambiguous, which is if they are perfectly clear about what it is, then the state law is going to have to yield to the federal law under the Supremacy Clause, and it's no longer going to be a question of which system we preferred. So we have the National Vaccine Act, right, which has its own elaborate scheme. There is no way that anybody can try to say, well, I'd like to get a state tort action to deal with these things, or whatever the federal procedures are, the panels, the procedures, and so forth. Those are the things that are going to govern. So I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that if Congress is pretty clear about what it wants to do, it can do it. The difficulty in this area often arises because of what sometimes arises, the presumption against preemption in the case of various kinds of illnesses. And this sort of stuff has happened all the time with respect to various kinds of medicine. So if you take drugs and it results in some kind of an adverse condition and you've gotten an FDA warning, which is completely thorough about what's going to happen, you can lose. So there's a drug called Phenergan, which is given to people in order to deal with certain kinds of pain. There are adverse side effects that can take place with it if you administer it improperly. There was a famous case in which what happened is some doctor found a patient, administered the drug to her. What she did, in effect, is the administration was too heavy a dose. The dosage in question was administered in an artery instead of in the vein, palpable malpractice. The doctor, in turn, testified against against the drug company for giving inadequate warnings, which were only 2 pages long. And Justice Stevens, in what I thought was a terrible opinion, announced that you could bring that particular action because there wasn't an explicit preemption provision. And that shows the kind of danger, because essentially no federal warning is adequate if you can bring a tort suit. That's not because they're not adequate. It's just because the way in which this litigation is gone, there is no way a defendant can get a summary judgment on a warning question. So everything then is a matter of testimony. And let me mention why this is so important. A summary judgment is a term that lawyers essentially understand is critical to the operation of every legal system, and laymen have probably never heard of it. But what a summary judgment says is there is no genuine factual dispute that has arisen with respect to this case, so that the defendant is now entitled to win the case without having to go through a trial. And if a plaintiff knows that there is a summary judgment at the other end, the suit doesn't get brought. And so in all of these kinds of drug cases that you're starting to see about, if the warning was deemed to be fully adequate, then in effect there's no way you can sue for failure to warn, and the case isn't brought. But the moment you take the position that Justice Stevens took, and you say, hey, the question of the warning is something for a jury to decide. The FDA's input on this is evidence, but it's not conclusive evidence, then everybody can sue. And under these circumstances, the way American tort law has worked, and I think it's genuinely dangerous, is that juries have a really good shot to say you should have given a stronger warning than you really did. And after the fact, it's easy to say what you want that stronger warning to be. And then you assume whatever thing you did wrong made the difference in whether or not the disease was or was not incurred. So if you do allow the torts cases to go through on COVID underneath the current standards, the plaintiffs are going to get to a jury every time, which means that this thing is going to be a complete, absolutely chaotic situation. And so what Congress could do as a compromise position is to say, what we will do is allow you to bring actions to the extent that people have deviated from federal standards. That may help the drug companies, but there are going to be all sorts of other people out there, occupiers of premises, doctors, and so forth, who are not drug companies, who can't get the benefit of that kind of provision. And if all of those are sued, it's going to be nightmarish. And then, of course, they'll turn around and they'll sue each other. The system will essentially crack under the kind of strain, because the formal theories of liability are much less important than the mechanism of causation that distributes these illnesses. And it's at that particular point that the COVID, which is rapidly contagious in many kinds of ways, is going to create a legal environment from which nobody will be able to escape.
There was talk last week when the president issued his executive order putting meat processing plants under the Defense Production Act, that language subsequent to that EO, which we haven't seen yet, was going to delineate the limits on liability in those kinds of operations. But on an issue like this, how much latitude does the president have to operate via things like executive orders? Or is this something that pretty much has to come through congressional legislation? Richard?
If the president has the power to do something in these particular cases by way of an executive order, that is to deal with something on the question of how you operate the plants, I think there's very little doubt that so long as Congress is in silent, it is silent, it is necessary and proper for him to decide to determine what the particular liability rules are. And what a president can certainly do is he can say, look, I want to get rid of this liability system, but what I'm going to put into place instead is any COVID worker who gets such and such a situation is going to get $10,000. Any COVID worker who gets that kind of situation is going to be entitled to participation under a workman's compensation plan. All of that stuff I think he can perfectly do. The vulnerability about an executive order comes from the fact that the Congress could look at this thing and say, we don't think this is sufficient protection, pass a piece of legislation and override a presidential veto. And at that point, the executive order is no longer going to dominate the situation. So what Trump or any other president has to rely upon is inertia to make sure that the situation that he puts forward is the situation that is going to essentially remain throughout the entire case. And, you know, these cases are so plastic, it's so uncertain what this particular environment is. There's so many difficulties in drafting these executive orders in ways that will be bulletproof. There are so many different attitudes that courts, both federal and state, will take to this thing, that even if you try to put this scheme into place, ambiguity and confusion will follow. That is, what I said was, if the order is explicit that there are going to be certain kinds of bars, that will dominate an implied right that you have under some of these other kinds of cases. But even if it's explicit and it turns out to be ambiguous, you then construe the ambiguity against the government and you're off to the races again. This is a really hard thing to be able to contain, I mean. But my view is that if you open the door a little bit, every plaintiff lawyer that I know is going to be able to push it wider. And interestingly enough, what happens is all the defense lawyers won't go there and say, please shut this door. They will say, keep it narrow. Because defense lawyers don't make any money if plaintiff's lawyers don't sue them. And that dynamic has been with us from the beginning of time. I just give you one story, which kind of shows this. Back in January of 1978, I represented the insurance company in California with a reform package of legislation that was designed to reduce the exposure to tort liability. About a week or two before, the California Supreme Court had handed down a case called Barker and Lowe. And in that particular case, it is now in a bizarre standard for liability, broader than that had been anywhere else. So the plaintiffs get up there, and they're perfectly predictable as to what they're going to go on. Katie barred the door. I get up there, and I said, look, this is not a viable standard. Then they got a defense lawyer to get up there, and I'll never forget what that person said. He was very smart. He says, we understand that there are certain difficulties, but I want to assure Professor Epstein that if somebody gets adequate defense counsel during one of these cases, they are well able under the existing law to defend themselves and to defeat liability, right? And so what he wants to do is he wants to win cases. I, representing the insurance companies, didn't want anybody to try them. And what happens is that attitude by defense lawyers, pleading faintly for modest reform, means that the plaintiffs will get their way in litigation. So it's the industry that is trying to stop all of this. The defense bar essentially does not wish to cut itself out of the potential gains. They know that they have to keep their clients happy, so they argue for some kind of prudent compromise. The difficulty when you're dealing with diseases is very different from other cases. That is, you look at product liability cases and you put aside the residual asbestos cases. The number of suits is down. With one exception, which is warning cases and drugs. And the reason it's down is the amount of defects that happen in product is way down because these products are much better than they ever were before. And what you were talking about in Barker v. Lowe was a front-end loader, which was used to basically hoist various kinds of bars for construction projects. The virus, there's no way that technical improvements are going to reduce the potential exposure in this case. So product liability here will be at a scale absolutely unmatched, even by the stuff that went on in the 60s and 70s. I know it sounds somewhat strange, but the single best defense in medical malpractice cases is, in fact, the good procedures and good instrumentation. Because if you can effectively show how this thing worked and do it right, you go into court and you have a series of films and other things which makes it perfectly clear that the operation was fine, which then makes it much more likely that somebody died from a cerebral hemorrhage or from some other kind of natural impulse that takes place inside the body, independent of the system. At the COVID, you don't have any of that stuff going to you. Technical advances mean that you're trying riskier treatments. Riskier treatments means that you're going to get even a greater exposure to liability, because medical malpractice liability really only began at a time when people actually believed that doctors could do some good. So if they screwed up, there was at that particular point a reason to go after them. Now, in effect, nothing that is sophisticated by way of measurement and techniques will help the defendants. What they will do is they will allow the plaintiffs to get extremely powerful experts to testify as to the source of something, and you're off to the races. Every case will be a trial. There'll be no summary judgments, and if there's no summary judgment, there's going to be no viable legal system.
Last thing that I'll ask you, in terms of the legislative horse trading, the liability protections right now are being pushed on the Republican side to try to get a deal with Democrats who are pushing for relief funds for state and local governments. Now, obviously, the tax receipts in a lot of places are way down. There's also some real reservations amongst Republicans, though, about what any aid would look like. The big concern that they don't want to shovel money to places that had pre-existing financial problems. And when you're talking about state and local governments, the ones that come immediately to mind on that score are for ones with big public pension liabilities. So what's your view on the proper role for Washington, which is already taking on a truly extraordinary amount of debt here, in propping up the finances of those other jurisdictions?
I mean, look, this is a crisis in the making. Right now, the huge expansion in free paper money has probably not had really strong effects because the velocity and the turnover rate of money is so slow because people aren't into the economy. But you get all this stuff sloshing around, and then you start getting a somewhat higher degree of expenditures. It's not at all clear that we will be able to avoid a major inflation, which comes from the fact that we now have a huge number of dollars chasing a very much more limited number of goods. And so far, essentially, everybody has looked about the money as saying, well, the government is solvent and it could always print money. States can't do that. But if the federal government did this, then, and you really thought it was a great scheme, then what you would want to do is to say, okay, what we're going to do is we're not going to use taxes for anything. We'll just always print money. So a zero tax rate is going to go there. Well, we know that the system will explode under those circumstances because of the depreciation in the currency. Basically, expanding these plans in order to satisfy the state raises very substantially the risk of major financial dislocations at the federal level. What you have to do is to understand, in order to deal with the inflation risk, what you have to do is you have to reactivate the economy so that there are more goods and services out there, so that the dollars have a larger base to which to trace. And you have to do this for a whole number of reasons, because if you start looking at this now, the COVID stuff, it turns out, is disappointingly persistent, and there are lots of disputes as to why that's the case. But what is surely becoming the case is the number of suicides is going to go up, the number of long-term cases of depression are going to go up. The number of accumulated cases where people haven't had tests for diabetes and for heart attack and so forth are going to go up. That the number of deaths and serious injuries that will come from these collateral consequences will, in my judgment, exceed the number of deaths that have happened with respect to the COVID, a number which I think is probably inflated because of the change in the standards by which reporting takes place. Some weeks ago, I wrote a paper on the Hoover site, making just the following simple-minded observation. You look at the 1% from COVID and you see the number of deaths. Then you've got the rest of the population, say 330 million people out there. And what you do is you posit a death rate from a failure of other kinds of medical treatment, suicides and so forth, of 0.1%. That's one part in 1,000. That's 330,000 deaths. It turns out the problem with the COVID people is they only are worried about deaths from one kind of medical sort. So you put all of this stuff together and you continue to lock down the economy. What's going to happen is those things are going to snowball. They're going to increase at an exponential rate. And once they increase at an exponential rate, we're going to be ill-equipped to be able to deal with all of those kinds of things. And, you know, you listened 10 days ago to Governor Cuomo, not my hero, to put it mildly. He started to talk about trade-offs. You listened to him the other day. I mean, my heart went into my mouth because he says there are no trade-offs. My daddy taught me that life always comes first. The economy comes after the health. What's wrong with that is health is on both sides of this. There are going to be health risks to staying shut like there are health risks to getting open. If you have somebody who simply has lexical priority, deal with coronavirus before you look at anything else. You're going to have huge numbers of deaths from other sources. And you know what's going to happen, Troy? People are going to start thinking about malpractice, product liability actions, occupier's liability actions, workman's compensation actions for all of those excess deaths and conditions as well. This country is really on the edge of a dangerous precipice. And what I find so frightening is that, apart from a few libertarian and conservative commentators, there's huge, very respectable support for the current status quo, even though I think that the thing remains ultimately untenable. So if you want to know what I think is going to happen, I have no good prognostications of what's going on. I think the people who are going to be hit the worst, oddly enough, are going to be people at the bottom of the economic pile, because people with some degree of substance can diversify their portfolio. They've got stocks, they've got bonds, they've got houses. But if you're living from paycheck to paycheck in an increased environment of uncertainty, risk, and health danger, and you don't get the paycheck, you're going to be in a really dangerous situation. So wealth transfers are not going to solve this particular problem. You have to open this thing up. And the Democrats at this particular point basically believe that a command and control economy to control COVID is what is going to get things going better again. I can't think of a more dangerous prognosis than that. It is oblivious to every other form of peril that we have now. It may well be that we will lose 100,000 people to COVID, but we may well lose 1 million people to something else, and we have to be aware of that fact as well.
You've been listening to The Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.